Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, March 22nd, 2018. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 73-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few reads and ask you to subscribe. $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. Go to iTunes, subscribe, go to Stitcher, subscribe, leave a review, leave two reviews, leave five reviews. Just use different names so that, you know, we trick them. This is very important because Jonah Goldberg, again, is insulting me on the Remnant podcast about the relative sizes of our audience, and you don't want him to win. He's just not, even though he has a wonderful article in the current issue of Commentary, now available at CommentaryMagazine.com and in your mailbox very shortly, an article about Karl Marx and his role in and position in the history of Jew hatred and anti-Semitism. Remarkable piece by John Goldberg. But he's wrong that his podcast is more popular than this podcast, and you need to prove it by giving us good reviews. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Saurabh Amari, our senior writer, back from travels abroad. Hi, Saurabh.
Hi, John.
So I guess as we speak, the House of Representatives is voting to pass a almost $2 trillion omnibus spending package that will take keep the government open until the end of September, at which point, presumably, there will be continuing resolutions so that they can get this past the election. What we have here is really the end of the legislative season, the legislative role of this Congress and Trump, and this is everything that's in here and that has happened thus far will be what the congressional elections will run on, and the midterm elections, and what people will be talking about if they are talking about issues at all, which is really not clear. Abe, one of the most interesting aspects, I think, is the enshrinement, now both parties agreeing to massive increases in defense spending.
Yep, and this is a good thing. As we were talking about before, this is sort of making up for the sequester, which took a big chunk out of defense spending. Trump had said, Even though he is not interested in American military intervention, he has spoken since campaigning, even before becoming president. He spoke about the necessity of building up the military, building up the great, such a beautiful, big, strong military, and so on. So this is in that sense, this is consonant with that. But far beyond Trump, it's a good, strong, necessary move.
Much of it is dedicated to replenishing the deleted stocks of the American arsenal, because when the sequester was agreed to in 2011, which was a gambit that Barack Obama had attempted to bluff the Republicans in the Congress with, on the grounds that they would never agree to a freeze in defense spending, and therefore he could sort of force them to to let him have some money for domestic spending by threatening defense spending. And then it turned out that the Tea Party Republicans who had been elected in force really didn't care about defense spending and were perfectly happy to freeze. And so the sequester's been in place for, I guess, 6 or 7 years. And the net result has been that we have continued to fight in Afghanistan. We've been fighting ISIS in ISIS land. We've been doing all sorts of things with our military, and you know that means we're using up our weaponry and not replacing it, so that if we ever need it, we will not have a healthy stockpile. Also, there's a lot of money for salary increases and, you know, pay increases and benefits for military people.
And this also comes at a time when people like Vladimir Putin are bragging about their Russia's military buildup and hypersonic weaponry and whatnot. So,
well, it's not all sunshine when it comes to Defense Department acquisitions. I mean, we just came off a giant scandal involving the F-35, which was a disaster and a complete waste of money. So I'm not entirely thrilled by the idea that we're going to have a whole bunch of new investments in platforms. What we need are investments in existing platforms that work.
Right. Well, that's an important point. And, you know, the military's hunger is constantly hungering and yearning for, new baubles and shiny new, objects, in part because they're easier to sell. It's a little like the world of nonprofits. If you want to understand why it is that something like the F-35, a disastrous bomber that doesn't really work,
but costs $25 billion a piece.
Yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's because it's easier to go to Congress and say, look, we got this fantastic new plane. And, you know, Boeing or McDonald's, whoever it is going to build it, also lobbies hysterically for it, as opposed to saying, we're just going to build some old plane. We're going to build on the old model because it's like, what? It doesn't have Wi-Fi? What? It's not, it's not stealth and, makes you a milkshake and is an instant pot. I mean, it should all be all things. And just as it's easier, like at a college, rather than to raise money to run the college, but to raise $1 billion to build an unnecessary building, this has been true of the military forever.
Anywhere where the font is the taxpayer dollars is wasteful and misused. This is one of John McCain's big issues, is addressing wastefulness in R&D and acquisitions, which is just a black hole, especially when it comes to the Pentagon.
But, there was a real risk toward the end of the Obama administration of having a sort of hollowed out military because you had a combination of overstretch and long neglect of capabilities, of procurement, of research and development. And so I think this is important to note that this is, on the whole, it's positive and in keeping with the president's campaign rhetoric. It also, in some other sense, undermines the campaign Trump, because just a week ago we had the new numbers from NATO come in for 2017 spending. And in 2017, the journal just did the story last week, only three countries met the requirement to spend at least 2% of their gross domestic product on defense expenditures. And those are Greece, Estonia, and the UK. Other countries like Romania and Poland were expected to hit the 2%. The only reason they didn't is that their economies unexpectedly grew faster than they expected, so they then ended up, their defense expenditures fell short of 2%. But across Europe, the pattern still holds. Germany in 2017 was around 1.5%. France could have come close, but again, partly because its economy grew a little bit, it fell short. You still have the basic imbalance within NATO that the U.S. ends up shouldering about two-thirds, 60 to 70% of all overall defense expenditures within the Western alliance. For all of Trump's threats, really, the Europeans are not catching up. And so by increasing the U.S. defense spending, I think what you're seeing is basically an administration that is locked into the same post-war tradition, at least as far as Europe goes, of being the dominant spender, of shouldering most of the responsibility. Of course, the U.S. has commitments beyond Europe and beyond NATO, which is one reason we do that. But the allies are not paying up, and Trump doesn't really have a way to make them pay up. And he's not shortchanging the U.S. defenses just because the allies are failing to.
So I have a big problem with this argument paradigmatically, and I've been making this argument for about two and a half, three years now. First of all, Donald Trump has a habit of conflating NATO costs, because NATO actually isn't a thing that has costs, and we pay for most of it, with military expenditures. In other words, how much a country pays for its military and how much money it puts into its own military. And the United States puts in the most to its own military because, we have the most commitments. Now, there's a way to get militaries or nations to pay more into their military. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe generally military expenditures are up pretty much across the board, even though most nations in Europe still don't meet that 2% GDP, equivalent of GDP threshold. And that is to make your neighborhood really dangerous. There's one reason why Estonia meets the requirement and Germany does not. Estonia is under threat. Greece meets the requirement, but everybody else in the region does not. These are on the periphery, so they meet these requirements for a reason. If the United States wants to enforce some sort of spending discipline in Europe on its military, get out. Make it impossible for you not to spend a lot on your military. That's not in America's interest.
But that was right. So that was Trump's gambit, right? We should get out of NATO. It's a bad deal. Well, NATO's actually a good deal, but there is this continuing fact, which is the NATO treaty obliges countries to spend at least 2% of their GDP on defense, right? So now, if they don't do it, they're of their own budget, not right. to NATO, okay? If they don't do it, and the argument is made, and I think it's a perfectly sensible argument, that means that we are in effect subsidizing, if NATO should be, we are in effect subsidizing their welfare states. They're not spending money.
Absolutely.
They're spending money on domestic programs rather than on their military, and we're picking up the slack. So having said that, I think there are very strong grounds on which it is a good thing that the United States picks up the slack. And I'll explain it to you very simply, which is that NATO is an alliance in which we are the senior dominant member and almost every other country is a junior member, with the possible exception of Great Britain. And that's necessary because NATO would be NATO could not function as this alliance of democratic Western states if it were like the UN and everybody sort of essentially had the same vote. Because in the end, you got to commit troops. You got to do there are various things you have to do, exercises, make decisions that you have to make. And if we are not the predominant power in NATO by a very great margin, we would also have the situation in which, as some people said in the late 90s, I don't think it was really fair or true, that we were subordinating our military interests to NATO's, for example, in getting involved in Bosnia, and that like people were flying under the NATO flag instead of the U.S. flag, wearing the wrong color helmet because there's a NATO helmet and that there was the U.S. helmet. But in the end, I think it's understood that what liberated Kosovo was the United States, really, with NATO help. It wasn't NATO, and we were just a subordinate member of NATO. And when we have subordinated ourselves, as was the case, say, in the incursion into Libya in 2010, 2011, the results have been parlous because we decided we should not be responsible for the end result. And NATO wandered, France and everybody else, wandered off gaily to go back into their little, shells and didn't do anything about stabilizing Libya or making sure that it, didn't descend into a charnel house.
Most dangerously is the reality that I think everybody at this table understands, which is that Europe, faced with a threat by Russia and a less committed United States to defend that threat, doesn't commit a whole lot of money to its defense expenditures. It starts cozying up to Russia. This is just about mm-hmm. and that's not just European pusillanimity. It's international relations theory. When you have a dominant pole that is a threatening pole that is closer to you than the other pole, you have a choice. You bandwagon or you balance against it. That's just waltz. And whatever you think of waltz, I think that theory is pretty well established. And just about everybody in this environment would probably choose bandwagoning.
No, just to echo John and Noah, it really is worth it for the United States. Europe is our largest trade partner taken as a whole. We are invested in Europe's security because ultimately the threats that surround Europe eventually get to the United States as well. We share enemies and adversaries in Russia. You look at the most recent crises in the world. All of them have happened, on Europe's periphery, whether that's ISIS or Ebola or whether it's the migrant crisis, Syria, what have you, so in Ukraine. So it really is worth it to be invested in Europe because it's a sort of frontline defense. And at the end of the day, these are the powers who always side with us. When the U.S. wants to go to war somewhere, these are the people who vote with us at the United Nations. And so
also, you want to look at your historical timeline here. So it was only 73 years ago that Europe ceased, as a result of the end of World War II, to be the least stable, most, you know, a centerpiece of constant war and struggle among, you know, the world's most developed countries. And maybe 70 years is enough for this to have broken itself forever and it will never happen again. But is that a bet you want to take?
No, not at the moment with nationalism on the rise.
Yeah, exactly.
And considering that Russia just invaded and annexed territory for the first time since 1945. It just happened. It can happen again.
Right. There are some other things in the omnibus that are pretty interesting. One thing I think is worth mentioning is in the House bill is the passage or the inclusion of the Taylor Force Act, so named after an American who was murdered by a Palestinian terrorist jogging down the beach in Tel Aviv. And it effectively cuts the Palestinian Authority off from American funds because it disperses these funds to the families of killers. We published a really great piece about this by Sandra Gerber and Douglas Feith a couple of years ago, and the way in which this the Palestinian Authority, despite it supposedly being the moderating force against Hamas and all of that, encourages terrorism by making it clear that it will provide support to the families of terrorists who are killed in the act of committing terror for the rest of their lives, thus subsidizing it and making it more possible and more cost effective. This comes at a time when the Palestinian Authority is at very low ebb, as we can see. They're depressed, they're demoralized. They understand that the United States is tilted really decisively toward Israel, and nobody else in the world cares. Nobody cares. Mahmoud Abbas was brought to Saudi Arabia by the
Mohammed bin Salman,
right, who is, what is his title?
He's crown prince.
So he's crown prince, right. So was brought and told to resign, and basically told that the Saudis would cut him off, Saudis being the main source of the Palestinian Authority's external monies. They're under, you know, they're under siege, and there's, and this I think also is important because the United States simply should not be supporting, you know, the murderers of Taylor Force were getting paid by the government of the Palestinians for murdering an American. So that I think is a pretty good thing.
Yeah, Abbas is also sort of acting like he's under siege too. I mean, he's sort of failing at the double game that he used to play in terms of saying one thing to one audience and another to another. I mean, he's been sort of out on a limb condemning U.S. and
he called
Israelis.
Called our ambassador David Friedman a son of a dog.
Right.
In a speech, called the U.S. ambassador a son of a dog. That's somebody that we're supposed to be sort of like acting as though he's an acceptable interlocutor. This, by the way, himself a terrorist murderer, financer of terrorism, a disgusting anti-Semitic piece of filth.
And also the Taylor Force
Act. Aside from everything else.
I think lends retroactively more weight to the embassy move. At the time, the embassy move was, you know, it was to be applauded for sure, but there was, you know, a lot of talk about how, in practical terms, it doesn't sort of mean all that much. But I think you take the two together, and it really sort of announces a change on the ground.
For the United
States. New reality,
States.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, a couple other things. There is almost $700 million in this omnibus bill to deal with the potential problem of Russian election hacking. So that this is worthwhile because we got systems in all 50 states clearly need to be hardened. They're being probed. At least one we were told was somehow gotten into, even though no results were changed or anything like that. There's like $300 million for the states and to be distributed, and then apparently another $300 million for FBI to strengthen or improve FBI's ability to investigate hacks, you know, at the SIGINT level, which I think is a pretty good thing. And $3 billion for opioid, to fight the opioid war. Now, this is, I think, tragically is a boondoggle, because the truth is that, you know, to give states money to, you know, to deal with programs to help people who are, you know, who have fallen prey to this terrible addiction is sounds really nice, but the horrible truth is that they still don't have good treatments. You know, the best treatment is methadone, which is 40 or 50 years old and has very, very limited positive results. And if you're if you give all these states enough money so that every police every police cruiser has Narcan or Narcolone, which is this thing that you can inject to prevent to bring someone back from an overdose, the horrible unintended consequence of this drug, as everybody says, is that it suggests that users will ride the wave as far as they can with the idea that they'll be brought back from death if they go too far.
It's a moral hazard.
And then it's a total moral hazard or a behavioral hazard. Yeah. So it's a kind of sad thing. It's like a good thing nationally that we recognize the terrible circumstance, and it's a horrible thing because I'm not sure that money is going to...
Is there a policy response to the opioid crisis, or is it more of a sort of emotional, you know, national, spiritual, moral problem?
I mean,
I don't know if there's
more people are dying every year. More people are dying every year from opioids than died yearly at the height of the AIDS epidemic. I mean, this is the worst. Oddly enough, it appears this is the worst drug crisis that we have ever gone through.
And that's just, by the way, but that's just the deaths. I mean, the ones who lived through it, are also, we're also talking about, scores of ruined lives.
And then these horrible stories of children where they're in the car while the parents are shooting up or whatever, and it's so awful.
Well, I mean, again, I can only commend to people, I've mentioned this three or four times, the book to read, probably the most important book published this decade, Sam Quinones' Dreamland, which is about how this crisis happened, this weird double helix effect of the introduction of black tar, heroin, very easily transportable from Mexico, and the rise of the misuse of prescription opioids as a result of 15 different things that happened in this country from the 70s to the 2000s. Some of that, the barn door is being closed. It's much harder for people to get these prescription drugs through Medicaid, which is one of the ways that this thing sort of shot forward.
That also creates its own problem too, which is that there's a new population of chronically people with chronic pain conditions that are having a hard time getting medication.
Right, but of course the part of the problem here was, from what we understand, that there was a new liberal approach, I mean liberal not in the political sense, toward dealing with pain beginning in the 1980s, where the idea was treat pain, like we're not treating pain well enough. The reason that we hadn't treated pain well enough was literally because after the First World War, a million people got addicted to morphine because they were being treated for their pain, and it was thought that the results of being a morphine addict were so awful. The idea was it was better to restrict pain medication in order to avoid the possibility that somebody could end up in this horrible spiral, right? So they got liberal about this, and drug companies wanted them to, and there was a whole, but it was all like for good motive. And then it turned out that people with chronic pain, there were way fewer people with chronic pain than we realized. There were many more people who were willing to say that they had chronic pain in order to get themselves access to this stuff. And that this decision that was made out of totally, sort of thoughtful humanitarian reasons had the most horrendous unintended consequence practically of our lifetimes.
There are also at least two Obamacare components here. Not that anyone would rightfully blame Obamacare for the opioid crisis, but one is that it made the price of the most addictive drugs absolutely bottom out. So you know, you can get like 200 pills for a few dollars or something in certain states. And the other is that a lot of funds went to states that had high rankings of sort of patient satisfaction surveys.
Right.
And a lot of these patient satisfaction surveys were really a measure of how willing doctors were to give them the drugs they wanted.
Yeah, and these pill mills, that there were these sort of very shady prescribing factories, and one of the things that they insisted on was that the patient not only come in, pay whatever, fill out these patient satisfaction forms, which would keep the Medicaid money flowing. So anyway, Sam Quinones's Dreamland is the must read book of our time, and you should read it, and then you'll be really, really sad.
So I don't think you can move on from Omnibus without discussing what is not in it, which is probably the biggest Omnibus story that's going to outlast the vote on this bill, unless you're a House Freedom Caucus guy and you're really into the Overseas Contingency Fund as a big slush fund, then you're going to be focused on the fact that funding for the wall isn't there. And this is, by my count, the fourth opportunity that the White House has had to get wall funding to the tune of $25 billion, over $20 billion. It's gone back and forth, but 20-plus, and whiffed on it. Had the chance, wouldn't compromise, wouldn't budge off their position. And their position, by the way, was not the wall, but external accessories to the wall to get a Democratic buy-in, and passed on it. So we're starting, and I think I'm going to write on this later, is we have to talk about the extent to which Donald Trump is really all that committed to this wall thing.
So Trump, one of his big campaign points at the moment is that the Democrats don't care about the Dreamers. They really don't care about them. They don't care about DACA. They don't care about fixing DACA because they want it as a campaign issue. And I'm wondering, Noah, whether this is a form of projection, not that it's not true, but that Trump has already decided that he would rather have the wall as a campaign issue than have the wall be constructed.
Well, here's the latest thing. The latest back and forth was the White House wanted wall funding to the tune of $25 billion and DACA, skinny DACA. So DACA recipients who are on the books, 600 some odd thousand of them, get permanent status legally, and that's that. Democrats countered $25 billion for the wall, but we want big DACA, which is half the DACA population by estimate. Not everybody who's on the books, some people who aren't on the books, some eligible, but citizenship for them. And this went exactly the same way it went the last time we had a government shutdown, which was, I guess, 2 months ago, not even, over this very same issue. No counter from the White House. Dead letter. Drop the ball. Walk away. And this tracks well with, I guess, the very first... And this is a distant memory, but it was early 2017 when the wall was a very much a live issue, and Paul Ryan had floated a proposal for a border adjustment tax that would have essentially funded the creation of a wall and made Mexico pay for it. And they didn't want that either. So we're coming to the point now where it's got to seem like the White House just can't take yes for an answer.
But it still loves, Trump still loves the wall theater, though. I mean, think of the things that, he goes and looks at the prototypes.
Sure.
For the new high-tech walls.
And what Republicans should be scared of is that it's not Democrats who are going to take the blame for this. Trump will campaign against Republicans. It's all he knows how to do. It's all he's ever done. And the base is jazzed by it, far more jazzed by it than they are by the opposition. They really think Republicans are out to get them. They don't want them. They don't like them. They're not interested in their interests. They condescend and look down on them. And this is the perfect way to ensure Trump against what Dan Henniger in the Wall Street Journal, I think, prophetically wrote about, which is the coming backstab from the GOP, the coming abandonment of this guy who is a political liability. The second they find out he's a political liability, thereabouts in November-ish, And this is going to be the perfect tool to keep the keep everybody on the reservation.
So he doesn't get the wall, and he says, "I need the wall," and he has the wall as a continuing issue, and he uses it as a threat against his own people. I think it's more likely that Trump, continuing the populist message, simply runs as the anti-Congress president, that he says Congress. The odd thing is that they're actually, and this is, I think, a very peculiar thing to look at. Let's compare two midterm elections quickly. So we have an upcoming midterm election here, 2018. We don't know what's going to happen. The hope the Democrats have is it will be a reverse version of 1994. Clinton becomes president in 93. He's got 43% of the vote. He tacks to the left. It's chaos in his White House. He replaces his chief of staff twice. They try to do Hillary care. It blows up. Republicans win 54 seats in the House, it's the Republican Revolution. Republicans take the House for the first time in four decades, right? Well, one of the things that they were running on was not only that Clinton was going left, but that he stunk. He was a lousy president. He wasn't getting anything done. I'm not sure you can say that about Trump. I mean, part of the problem for Democrats running against him is they want to run against him as the, you know, evil. He's both evil and incompetent. But and he may be both or neither. But there will be a history of some legislative accomplishment, not just the tax cut, but not just the tax cut. Within the tax cut was the ending of the Obamacare mandate, the most unpopular thing in Obamacare. There will be this omnibus spending package, which will increase funding for the military, which is popular, which will have bits and pieces of things that Republicans as well as Democrats can say they supported, like, you know, funding to harden the elections, or, you know, all this stuff, opioid stuff. It's not clear whether Trump is, you know, Republicans could be standing here saying we've done what we came here for. We're really, you know, we've done what we can do, or we're really trying hard or whatever. And it's the president who constantly steps on that story by deciding, announcing he wants to get into a fist fight with Joe Biden, by having, you know, the total chaos and churn in the White House and his precincts. As we were sitting here, we just got news that his chief lawyer, John Dowd, is quitting, and yet in the third or fourth shakeup of his legal team since the beginning of the Russia probe. It's just sort of endless, you know, chaos. So it'll be interesting to see whether, despite the accomplishments, Republicans still get their hats handed to them in 2018.
And you have these tariffs. I was just, this morning there were new tariffs announced targeting China, the Dow is down 500 points, nearly 500 points right now. I think it's exactly right. It's this impression of constant chaos, where I don't think if you ask the most people on the street, they would tell you the legislative accomplishments. They would tell you about the legislative accomplishments. They would point to the sense that there's constant chaos.
And here's the real risk of tariffs. The tax bill didn't turn out to be the nightmare disaster that Democrats said it was going to be. So Republicans got a bit of a rebound on that because they overreached. Democrats seriously overreached. I don't think a lot of people felt the 1.2% that they got back from reduced withholding in their paychecks. They will feel it when they have to pay 5, 6, 7 cents more per item that they buy from Walmart, because it adds up to about 10 or 15 bucks more per trip. They will feel that, and they will know that.
That's an important point that people don't make. You know, inflation was a political issue in the United States in the 1970s, not because it had this effect on your this or your that or the macro. It was that every week somebody went to the supermarket two bags of groceries that cost $30 in 1974, 1 week would cost $31.50 the next week, and $32 the week after, and $33.50 2 months after. And it was that feeling that your wealth was being chipped away by ordinary purchases across the board, not by, you know, giant things. This was why when Wilbur Ross, after the first tariffs, the Secretary of Commerce, went on TV and said, does it really matter that this can is going to cost 10 cents more than the... It's like...
Yes.
Well, it matters because nobody buys one can. Families of four buy seven cans. And does it matter that that's a dollar more? Yes, when it adds up every week of your life, and when you're not a billionaire who falls asleep in cabinet meetings, it matters if your bill goes up 10%.
And the instincts of demonstrated by that display should make just Republicans weep with fear, because it is so callous, so atonal, that it suggests that the White House doesn't really know what it's doing.
And yeah, economically illiterate.
Right. And besides that, by the way, if it should turn out that people don't feel it, because it turns out that the secret is that America is actually wealthier, or people feel are wealthier than we think they are, or they feel wealthier than they think they are, that this stuff doesn't faze them that much, then the question is, what need is there for tariffs? What need is there for tariffs? And we just got word from the Fed yesterday that it thinks that the unemployment rate in the United States at the end of 2018 is going to be 3.6%. Which I believe would be the lowest number ever recorded, particularly when we have both genders, you know, working.
Now, I know we're going very far afield here, but Democrats are about to have their very own. The reason why we have these tariffs is because we have a sob story in the form of American manufacturing, and it is a real sob story. But Democrats are going to be running on their own form of tariffs, which in the form of and they have precisely the same sob story in the form of high rates of livery driver suicide. Suicide is on the rise.
Yes,
it's not something
they
even joke
I'm
about.
Not
people are
I'm
killing
not laughing. It's
themselves
true.
Because of Uber and Lyft. For real.
Yeah, there have been four cases in New York City in the last month.
Yeah. And that's a really sad story. But Uber and Lyft make people richer by freeing up their time and giving them more money, and the vast, vast majority benefit more than do the people who suffer from innovation. It's in the story of forever. But the taxi drivers are going to benefit because somebody's going to introduce some kind of protectionism for them, just like the president has for this nostalgic ideal of what constituted American industry in 1982. Oh, and also there's an arms race.
They're intensely protected already. The whole licensing process for cabs is an effort to limit the number of cabs on the street. So they went into the profession essentially expecting a windfall, and now there's an innovative.
But the Uber consumer does not have the better story. The suicidal taxi driver has the better story.
I would also like to point out that Uber took another hit, you know, this weekend, of course, with the news that the self-driving car in autonomous mode killed a woman in Tempe, Arizona, who was, you know, walking her bike across a crosswalk and got hit by a car. Now, here I bring this up only for one reason, which is the world of the unintended consequence also exists in tech, and you know the real world results of things also exist in these matters. And we have been told for years that, you know, really futurists say the self-driving car, this is the you know how radical this is, the self-driving car? No one's going to own cars in 30 years because you will use an app, the car will pull up. You'll get in, you'll drive somewhere, you'll get out, the car will go off and you don't have to own a car. You don't have to drive a car. You don't have to do anything. This is how the world is going to be. Well, I have this analogy for you, because the self-driving car is a very complex piece of machinery, and the question of whether it can coexist with people doing unexpected things on the streets and whether or not it can coexist with non-self-driving cars is very unclear. And here's my analogy, and then we have to go and talk about the Casper Wave mattress. The analogy is this. 20 years ago, one of the great thoughts was that we could end obesity in America. How? Because we were going to readjust fat, and we could create fat in a lab that would simply pass through your body and wouldn't, you know.
It was Olestra. Right?
Olestra.
Right.
It was marketed under the name of Olestra. And everybody was very excited. $1 billion, General Foods, they introduced $1 billion. And there it was. And they introduced it, and it turned out that it was disgusting. Not that it tasted disgusting, but that the end result after it passed through your body was disgusting. And it made you gassy, and then you don't want to know what else it made you do after at the end. And this thing, which had been sought for 20 years was going to change the American way of everything is gone. Alestra is gone. And the self-driving car may be the Alestra of high tech. Noah's shaking his head because he's Mr. High Tech, but I'm just saying 30 years from now, you'll remember that I said this, that I said self-driving cars were Alestra, and you won't remember what Alestra was. But you'll remember that there are no self-driving cars. Okay. Saurabh Amari, you got a Casper Wave mattress. The most innovative mattress from the sleep experts at Casper. The first mattress of its kind to relieve pressure at 36 different points. Advanced temperature regulating technology to help you sleep cool and comfortable without overheating during the night. 5 layers of superior foam, including a cushioning top layer for maximum comfort. Whether you're a back, stomach, or side sleeper, the Casper Wave gives you the support and relief you need for a good night's sleep. And thanks to its patent-pending contouring system, it adjusts to your body in natural curves, designed to keep its original form, so you'll be supported for years to come, no matter how much time you spend on it. High-quality sleep surface comparable to similar high-end mattresses on the market, but it costs less. Now you can experience, as Saurabh Amari has experienced, and we'll tell you, Casper's most innovative mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. And like all Casper mattresses, your Wave will be delivered right to your home in a small, how do they do that, size box. All Wave purchases come with in-home white glove delivery and set up for free. So Saurabh, tell us about, you know, you're now on like week 3 of the Wave mattress.
Yeah, I just came back from a very short trip to Israel where the trip itself took less time than the time I spent in air. Very miserable pair of flights back and forth, and I couldn't wait to get back to my Wave mattress, the Casper Wave. I slept last night for the first time a full night after those travels. Nice 8-9 hours uninterrupted, and woke up very refreshed. It's remarkably comfortable. I sleep on my belly. My wife sleeps on her back. We both love it.
Fantastic. So for $100 off your Wave purchase, visit casper.com/commentary100 and use promo code commentary100. That's 100. One more time, that's casper.com/commentary100 and use promo code commentary100 for $100 off your new Wave mattress. Terms and conditions apply. So we're running a little long here, but we do want to talk some about whether or not you about the do not congratulate gate. Do not congratulate gate, of course. The president congratulated Vladimir Putin on his staggeringly fraudulent election victory over the weekend, in which, as Noah pointed out during the pre-show, mysteriously 1.5 million voters magically appeared on the voting rolls.
It's not even mysterious. The fraudulence on display in the elections that were that took place in Russia last weekend was blatant, flagrant, right out in the open. You had observers not just from OSCE, but Reuters News Network on the ground in polling places, seeing people vote twice and having police officers say, there's nothing. So one of them suggested there's just twins. Lots of twins. The OSCE observed as 1.5 million new voters appeared magically out of the blue, 122% of the electorate or something like turned out, in order to get Vladimir Putin over 50% of the population to avoid a runoff election. They said it was a very controlled environment, which is suggestive of the fact that it was a very fraudulent and unfair election.
And the one person who could have posed a serious challenge to Putin, Alexei Navalny, was barred from running on trumped up corruption charges.
The chief, the woman who was the big opponent, gave an interview to RT where she said, before the election, there's a lot of sentiment. There's a lot of pro-Putin sentiment. Everybody really wants Putin. You got to know that heading into this election.
So somebody prepared a document for Trump, notes on what to do on the call or with the meeting, whatever, and it said at the bottom in capital letters, do not congratulate, and then he congratulated Putin on his stunning election victory. And then we found out through some means that we don't really understand yet that, in fact, he had been told specifically by his underlings not to congratulate, and that all these stories came out, 3 different versions of the story. One is John Kelly, the chief's furious that someone leaked that he had had this, and Kelly was going to go and kill whoever did it, and they would find out it's only a small number of people knew this. Or Trump didn't really see the guidance because he was on a phone. It was the phone. This was the print guide. There was a phone guidance and there was a print guidance. And so he didn't see it. So he didn't really violate it. And then Trump tweeted, oh, yeah, I did. I saw it. Yeah, and this, I said what I said anyway.
Narrative prevailed for about 12 hours. And right. The president got annoyed watching him on television and said, oh, yeah, no, I did it. I meant to do that.
Right. So and then there's, well, whoever did this is going to go to jail. Because this, he leaked it, and you see the leaks. It's a national. How can you work under these conditions where you're getting leaked? And then somebody else said, you know, it was probably that he called somebody.
Trump.
Trump called somebody to say, you know, they told me to say, do not congratulate. And I said, the hell with you. And I congratulated him anyway. So.
The worst. Probably
Which
the worst
sounds, I
of
think,
this.
The most plausible.
It's incredible. It's perfectly plausible. Yeah, because people are fretting over the precedent that this sets, and it is a terrible precedent. But it's most likely one that wouldn't be set by somebody, one of the six people who work this closely with the president. President, why would they jeopardize themselves like that? And they're very much aware of the precedents they're setting. The most upsetting thing of this whole episode was the way in which it forced Sarah Huckabee Sanders to humiliate herself and debase the country and the office she represents when she said that, well, asked whether or not she believed the Russian election was free and fair, said, you know, it's not our place to judge other people's elections. We can only judge our own elections, make sure our own elections are free and fair. That's stupefyingly silly nonsense. Sarah Huckabee Sanders herself has weighed in on the validity of elections as long as they're being conducted in Venezuela. The State Department weighs in on the validity of elections, whether they're free, fair, honest, or whether they're awful, and they do that all the time. The United States is and has always been an arbiter of free and fair elections abroad, and this double standard that this White House maintains for Russia is so conspicuous and so difficult to ignore at this point that I feel compelled to no longer defend their record on Russia, which is laudable. They have no interest in defending themselves on Russia. Why should I go out there in defense of this administration if they can't even muster up the courage to say, we're being harder on Russia than you ever gave us credit for, guys?
I largely agree with you on the Sarah Huckabee aspect of it, and of course on the congratulations itself. But I have to weigh in with a tiny bit of whataboutism. In 2009, in June of 2009, in the fraudulent Iranian election that put Mahmoud Ahmadinejad back as the Iranian president, days ensued in which Iranians were beaten and killed by besieged forces in protest to this election. The White House press secretary got up after all that and said that Ahmadinejad is the legitimate president of Iran. It is precisely the exact same thing.
And 2012, after liberals went so crazy over, oh my God, this is so terrible, the Trump, they're all saying that's so awful. And then, of course, Obama congratulated Putin on his election victory in 2012.
Right. I do have to. I'm normally the one often I tend to point to the actual policy accomplishments of this administration, which tend to be much tougher on the Kremlin than Obama ever was. That's true enough. But I think Noah has one point, which is that this is especially appalling because it came right after Russian intelligence agents brazenly, shamelessly used a nerve agent on the soil of an allied nation, Great Britain. And it's so bizarre when press secretaries get locked into these lines in defense of their bosses, where it hurts more than to just, I don't know, to pivot away or do some other tactic. Her saying that we don't judge elections reminded me her obstinacy on it of when Obama when the question came up about whether the shooting at the Jewish deli in Paris, do you guys remember this?
Right.
Was whether it was anti-Semitic, and Obama had denied it, I believe.
Yes.
And the White House was saying, going to bat to try to characterize it as something other than anti-Semitic. So,
So that's, I mean, there's a distinction, though, between spin, which is noxious, but it's not lying. There's a difference between spin and just brazen mendacity. And saying that we don't do something that we clearly do is mendacity. It's not spin. So there is a distinction there.
Right. We have a whole vast State Department apparatus that just puts out reports on whether
it's like a bold-faced lie. I mean, it's very much what Moscow does when they say, you know, she kidnapped herself, dude. Like, well, they're just lying.
I mean, the whole point about the role of Sarah Huckabee Sanders in this, and I insulted her on Twitter myself, but she has the material that she has to work with. You know what I mean? I mean, in the end, she is serving the interests of the person she works for, who makes it necessary for her to jump through these hoops, and who appears in part, I think, to maybe measure people by how willing they are to break these norms in support of him.
That's just it. I totally agree. But no one has a gun to her head. She has agency. This is the role she has chosen to play.
Well, you almost quoted The Godfather there. We've been sitting here for everything. We spent an hour trying to figure out who is who in The Godfather and which story. That, of course, was Hyman Roth, who did the this
like bigger than business. U.S. Steel.
Yeah, that's what we have chosen. And that's because everything in life really gets
Hyman
back
Roth
to The
benefited
Godfather.
Dramatically from steel tariffs.
Well, that's certainly true, by the way. And, of course, the ultimate tariff, which, you know, made every, you know, which the ultimate sort of cross-border incursion, economic cross-border incursion, which was bootlegging, made a lot of money. Your father, too. So we're not going to bore you with our Godfather impressions, though we may act out the Godfather, at both Godfathers at some point. Maybe we'll do... If we do Godfather 3, you'll probably agree with Jonah Goldberg that his podcast is better than ours. Anyway, so until next week, for Abe Greenwald, Noah Rothman, and Saurabh Amari, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.